I therefore lengthened mine, which had not yet grown long enough, with jet-black Yakuza hair, and in order to match that color I rubbed a wet stick of Chinese ink on my own brown hair. I hung large earrings on my ears, and they altered my appearance. Finally, I powdered my face with a mixture of cocoa and crushed charcoal, to obtain a dark complexion. The makeup was rather strange, but suppliers to the theatrical trade, from whom I could have obtained better ingredients, have not yet opened branches in the Tibetan wilds. At sunset, we gathered our baggage and emerged from the jungle full-fledged Tibetan wayfarers. The next morning we found as a camping ground, after our long tramp, only a most unhealthy place nearly level with the stream, and which was certainly part of its summer waterbed. We could not see the ground beneath us, it being hidden by reeds which had been burned in a forest fire and which had fallen in an inextricable entanglement now covered by a thick layer of green moss. We ate, but owing to the nearness of the road, we did not dare to light a fire, and drank the icy water that had an unpleasant taste. How long had I slept? I could not say. When I opened my eyes I saw a man clad in Tibetan dress, wearing a soft felt hat of foreign shape, as Tibetan soldiers outside of Lhasa do. In less than a second many thoughts dashed through my still slumbering mind. A Tibetan soldier, we are still on Chinese territory, what is he doing here? Has he been sent across the border to watch us? Have the Tibetan officials been informed that we are proceeding toward the Doka Pass? At any rate, I must convince him that I am a true Tibetan, and, as the best means of convincing him, I pretended to blow my nose with my fingers. That gesture thoroughly awakened me, and what I had taken to be the soldier turned out to be nothing more than a rock and a few branches. But I had not the heart to laugh at myself. I had been too much frightened, and to make things worse, I began to shiver in a way which left no doubt in my mind that I was in for an attack of fever as the result of our prolonged stay in that damp spot. I looked at my watch. It was only 3 o'clock, but days were short at this time of the year, and the waning moon did not rise until the middle of the night. During the next fortnight we should have to chance our luck and proceed partly during the day, or we would linger too long in the country, which would indeed be dangerous. Late in the evening we arrived at a peculiarly beautiful spot, a kind of wide, natural clearing surrounded by ramparts of thickets. Shadowed by giant trees which veiled an intense darkness, it looked like a temple meant for some solemn occult rites and made me think of the Druids. Pilgrims used to camp there, one knew it from the large number of mediums to be seen scattered about. Some Sybaritic devotees had gone so far in their search for comfort as to spread a double thickness of fir tree branches around the primitive hearths, in order to provide themselves with a carpet, and these dark green patches on the golden brown leaves which autumn had strewn over the ground still further increased the impression one had of being in a mysterious sanctuary. Big logs lay scattered around, and without taking much trouble we soon enjoyed a most glorious fire. Invisible animals were roaming in the jungles, we could hear the noise of the small branches they broke as they stalked through the bushes. Sometimes, we heard steps quite near us, maybe one of the four-footed wanderers was watching us, but we could not see it in the circle of darkness that surrounded the clearing, and veiled its farthest corners. I trusted, nevertheless, that no beast would venture near the heap of glowing coal from which, at times, flames leapt high and clear. With flaming branches in his hands, Yongdan went twice to fetch water from the river. I told him to chant some Tibetan liturgy all along his way, so that, together with the bright light, the noise would frighten away any leopards or panthers which might be prowling around. That grave samadhi in the depths of the forest matched perfectly the peculiar atmosphere of the place and aroused in me the desire to perform the fearful rite which Tibetan hermits hold in high esteem as a way of liberating one's mind from all attachment. It is poetic in spite of its stern symbolism, and Tibetans fully gotten wayfarers used to camp. I ignored the danger of being overheard by travelers, if any such should happen on the road, as had been my experience the night when I had imprudently spoken English near a torrent. If anyone saw me forming the figures of the mystic dance and calling upon the gods and the demons, He could but be convinced that I was a Tibetan Naljorma and, being struck with terror, would certainly not remain in the vicinity to ask idle questions. After a short rest, we did our best to start before daybreak, but the waning moon's light could not penetrate the thick foliage. We were not able to find our way, and had to return to our camp and wait. As we ascended the sacred mountain, the forest changed its character. It became darker and wilder than in the neighborhood of Londera. Our night tramp was wonderful. We felt as if we had entered another world. Born of the moon's rays, filtering through clouds and branches, or perhaps of other and unknown causes, strange shapes rose before us. Often we saw the glimmer of fires hidden in the recess of the mountains. Moving shadows were silhouetted indistinctly in the dim light. Peculiar notes were heard. Once, while walking ahead, I saw two tall figures coming toward us. Retracing my steps, nearly crawling on the ground to avoid giving ourselves away, I dragged Yongdan along the dry bed of a high-banked stream, and there we stayed, crouching amongst the stones and the fallen leaves, watching the intermittent glare of a fire at the foot of a distant huge perpendicular rock. Early in the morning, at the time when Tibetan travelers start for the day's march, we listened attentively, trying to detect sounds of human voices or the noise of animals. But the forest remained silent. I was more puzzled than ever, and, to gratify my curiosity, we went a long way off the trail to the big rock. It was surrounded by thorny bushes and a few dead trees. No suitable place for a camp could be found nearby. The rock itself had been decorated long ago, as are many in Tibet, with the image of Padmasambhava and some mystic formulae, but these had nearly disappeared beneath the moss. Of fire, embers, ashes, or charred wood, there was no trace. I noticed a long, narrow crevice between the ground and the rock, and here the stone seemed blackened with smoke. I thought, however, it was rather its natural coloring. Yongden and I roamed more than an hour in an attempt to discover the entrance of a cave beneath the rock. We found none. While we were busy, a few blackbirds alighted on some branches and appeared to follow our doings with a mocking interest, moving their heads and uttering chirps like laughter. Their noise was unpleasant and Yongden grew angry. "These little black fellows," he told me, "I do not seem to be natural birds. They must be the same mischievous Mimayina who play tricks at night with fire and music to delay us on the road, and have now taken another shape." I smiled at his imagination, but he was quite in earnest. His great-grandfather had been a somewhat famous magician Lama, and I believe the blood of that ancestor was now alive in him. He recited a Zung, magic formula, with the necessary ritualistic gesture and, strangely enough, the birds flew away, shrieking loudly. "You see," triumphed the young Lama, "I knew it. It is unwise of us to stay here." I smiled again, but as to the necessity of pushing on I could not argue. That very night we meant to cross the border of the Forbidden Land. The approach to the pass was most beautiful. Early morning found us in a large valley white with frost. On our left, strangely shaped rocky hills seemed crowned with turreted, apostrophe Mimayin, or literally, not man. One of the six classes of beings, AC according to Tibetans. 22. My journey to Lhasa, castles. At first sight I thought that a monastery had been erected there for the use of contemplative lamas, as there are a large number in Tibet, but I soon realized that nature was the only responsible architect, and had herself built these dignified yet graceful edifices. I very much regretted that the nearness of the border and the extreme care I had to take in order to avoid being seen, prevented me from camping a few days on this site. I would have liked to find a way by which I might climb into these fairy dwellings. Knowing Tibet and its people as I did, it would have been no surprise to me to have found a hermit in this eyrie. Proceeding toward a ridge which seemed to be the summit of the pass, we crossed several abundant springs. Water was flowing everywhere on natural terraces supported by rocky walls. In summer, Dokpas bring their cattle to these heights. We had seen signs of them in the valley, but at this time of the year silence reigned supreme. The belief that we had only a short distance to cover to be at the end of our climb infused fresh strength in us. We walked fast and soon arrived at a bend of the track, nearing the spot which we had taken for the pass. Here we saw that we had only reached another broad valley which, far away, was fringed by slopes which doubtless led to the Doka Pass, but the pass itself could not yet be seen. This was an unpleasant surprise. We were tired, for the troubles of the previous night had not allowed us much rest. Moreover, we did not deem it prudent to proceed during the middle of the day in that open place, in which we could be observed from every side. A chaos of huge rocks, very likely the product of some landslide that happened centuries ago, could, fortunately, be used as a refuge. Stunted fir trees were still thriving there, in spite of the high level, and served us as a shelter. From that place I could still see the tops of the fairy palaces that I had admired from the valley beneath, but I was now above them and thus could see that the other side of the hill was much less steep. 3. I have myself lived for several years, in caves or rough cabins, in the grassy desert and at the foot of the everlasting snows, the strange and wonderful life of the Tibetan mystics. I feel deeply its particular attraction, and all that is connected with it immediately awakens my interest. Now it appeared to me that those natural edifices were inhabited. A mysterious message seemed to be conveyed to my mind, as I sat gazing intently at them, a kind of silent talk between speakers invisible to each other. What did it matter, after all, if on that hill there lived a human being like myself? What I heard was the thousand-year-old echo of thoughts which are rethought over and over again in the East, and which, nowadays, appear to have fixed their stronghold in the majestic heights of Tibet. We set out again in the middle of the afternoon. We felt confident that no one would be on the road at that time. Tibetans always manage to cross these high passes at noon, to allow time to go far enough down on the other side to avoid excessive cold and lack of fuel during the night. We were not ordinary travelers, and the usual rules dictated by prudence could not be part of our own code, which consisted in one single article, to avoid detection. For the rest, we relied on our robust constitutions and the strength of our will. During the short halt that we made at the foot of the final climb, we noticed a man leading a horse, who had reached the beginning of the upper valley, near the place where we had camped, and from which I had gazed at the rocky castles and allowed my mind to dwell on their imaginary inhabitant. The man sat down when we moved on, and we lost sight of him. I may say at once that the following day he should have caught up with us, for there was only the one pilgrim's road and circumstances had delayed us long on our way. But he never appeared. We asked some pilgrims who overtook us about him, and they answered that they had met nobody. This fact somewhat confirmed my intuition as to the presence of a hermit in the vicinity. The man with the horse was probably, for my journey to Lhasa, his Jinda, supporter, who brought him a supply of food. He had left the track and would perhaps remain a few days with the Lama. That the majesty of that solitary site had been appreciated by an ascetic was not astonishing, for one who knew the Ksand of snows and its religious folk. The Doka Pass now stood before us, most impressive against a grey evening sky. It is a depression in a gigantic barren range whose cyclopean slopes sag like cables outstretched across rivers to serve as bridges. The knowledge that it marks the threshold of the guarded region added to the sternness of its aspect. The ground around the pass is most sacred to the gods, and the Tibetan pilgrims who walk along the track have built countless tiny altars, made of 3 standing stones, and a 4th one as a roof, under which offerings are made to spirits. On the pass itself and following the neighboring ridges, the mystic flags which can be seen on all the heights of Tibet were planted in exceptionally large numbers. In the falling light they looked alive, belligerent, and threatening, like so many soldiers scaling the crests, ready to fight the presumptuous traveler who would venture on the road to the holy city. As we reached the cairn marking the top, a gust of wind welcomed us. The violent, icy kiss of the austere country whose severe charm has held me so long bewitched and to which I always return. Turning successively toward the 4 quarters, there's anything than Adia, we uttered the Buddhist wish, may all beings be happy, and began to climb down. A blizzard descended upon the peaks, Black clouds rolled hither and thither, turning into sleet. We hurried in our effort to reach the base of this steep and inhospitable slope before nightfall. But darkness came early, we missed the path winding between the landslides, and found ourselves slipping helplessly with crumbling stones under our feet. It became dangerous to proceed in that way, with a speed that we could not control. So, succeeded in pulling up, we fixed our pilgrim strains before us in the ground as a point of support. Clinging to each other for safety, our loads still on our backs, we remained squatting upon the snow, which fell from 8 o'clock in the evening till 2 the next morning. Then the last melancholy quarter of the moon rose between the clouds and we descended to the wooded zone. We were resting, seated at the edge of a glade where a forest fire had destroyed the big trees and which was now covered with short shrubs, when I noticed the forms of 2 long animals with phosphorescent eyes, which crossed the track several times and finally disappeared in the direction of the river. They were quite distinctly visible in the moonlight and I pointed them out to Yonglin. He saw them well, but persisted in saying that they were deer, though their shape and the peculiar glimmer of their eyes indicated carnivorous wild beasts. I delayed a little, to avoid an undesirable encounter, and then we continued our descent to the river. We were exhausted and there was no certainty that we could soon find water again, as the stream entered a gorge and our trail climbed up on the hill. So, in the hope that the animals would let us alone if they were still in the vicinity, we lit a fire to make tea. While we were drinking, we heard some noise behind the bushes, but we were beginning to be accustomed to the prowling of wild beasts around our camps. Yonglin fell asleep. I decided to watch, but my eyes were heavy, and closed in spite of my efforts. I was dozing, when the sound of a low sniff awakened me. A few feet from the place where we were lying, one of the animals with glimmering eyes was looking at us, and I could see its spotted coat. I did not awaken Yonglin. It was not the first time that I had seen creatures of that kind at such close range. They seldom attack men unless provoked or wounded, and I was convinced that they would never harm me or those who were near me. My journey to Lhasa, that nocturnal meeting reminded me of another one which, we could not allow ourselves a longer rest. The day had broken and it was time for us to retire to a hiding place, away from the trail. I awakened Yonglin and we went. A few minutes after we started, the young man pointed out with his stick something under the trees. "There they are," he said. The pair of spotted fellows were indeed there. They turned their heads toward us, looked for a little while, and then went their way along the stream, while we climbed the path. As we went up, the aspect of the forest changed once more. It was now much less dense. The sun that had risen lit the undergrowth, and through the openings in the foliage we could see the opposite bank of the river beneath us. We noticed with astonishment that it seemed to be cultivated, but cultivated in a fanciful way, more in the fashion of gardens and parks than of common fields. It was a glorious morning, and we enjoyed our walk so much that we continued it long after the hour at which we usually sought shelter. The river bent suddenly and we confronted a village built on a slope at the foot of which our path turned along the stream. A few isolated houses could even be seen quite near us on the sides of the path itself. What village was this? It was not charted on any map and none of the people of the country from whom we had cleverly got information, before our departure, had ever told us a word about it. Its architecture was peculiar. We did not see cottages and farms, but villas and miniature palaces surrounded by small yet stately looking parks. The strange town was bathed in a pale golden light. No sound of human voices, no noises of animals, were heard in it, but, now and then, a faint silvery jingling struck our ears. We were amazed. Were we in Tibet or had we reached fairyland? We could not, however, remain standing in the path. People might come along, and to be seen so near the frontier posts was imprudent. It was imperative, for safety's sake, that we should delay our investigations until the evening. Once more we retreated amongst the bushes and the rocks. There, overtired, I sank on the moss and fell asleep, feverish and raving a little. Our impatience to see again the fantastic village, Our fear of having to cross an inhabited place, and the desire to look for ways to avoid it, brought us on the trail before sunset at the spot on which we had stood in the morning. Where were the graceful villas, the stately little palaces and the sunny gardens? The forest was empty. A severe landscape of dark trees extended before us, and a cold breeze, wailing among the branches, took the place of the harmonious jingling. "We have dreamed," I said to Yongdan. "We did not see anything this morning. All that happened while we were asleep, dreamed," exclaimed the Lama. "I will show you how we have dreamed. This morning, while you were looking at the miraculous town, I drew a Sungpo, magic sign, on a rock with the spike of my staff, so that neither gods nor demons could oppose our progress. I shall find it again." And he looked on a flat stone at the foot of a fir tree. "There it is," he triumphed. "Look. I saw the roughly drawn Sungpo. It silenced me for a moment. My son," I said, proceeding forward, "this world itself is but a dream, and so—" "I know," interrupted my companion. "Nevertheless, the Sungpo and the Ngags, magic words, that I uttered while drawing it, have dispelled the mirage. It was certainly the work of some who wished to delay us. Yes, like the blackbirds," I continued, laughing, "and maybe the small leopards, too."
"Like the birds, yes," affirmed my son, decidedly vexed. "As for the leopards, I do not know. They looked honest beasts. Anyhow, we will soon be out of these Kakapo forests and confront true villages instead of dreamland ones, and true men, officials, soldiers, and others, instead of Mi Ma Yin. Let us see, then, if we can manage our business with them as cleverly as I have done with the folks of other worlds." "Have no fear about it," I replied, "seriously, I will look after that."
"How will you do it?" he asked.
"I will make them dream and see illusions, just as the Mimens did to us. And I really did so when, a few days later, circumstances brought us before Tibetan officials. The miracle which had allowed us to proceed for a whole week on a road followed by many pilgrims, without meeting a single soul, could not last forever. Arrived at one of the minor passes on the Kakapo Range on our way down to the Selwyn, we suddenly heard a jingling of bells behind us. It was a party of pilgrims, men and women, with two horses, who had overtaken us. We exchanged a few words, and each of us walked devoutly around a latsu in which flags bearing printed mystic formulae were stuck. The pilgrims, who were not impeded by loads on their backs, went down the trail more quickly than we did, and, when we arrived at the bottom of a pretty, narrow valley in which several clear streams met, we found them already seated, drinking tea. We had now to begin the apprenticeship of the career we had momentarily embraced. It would have been contrary to the custom to pass the place without taking our meal, for the time had come for chapog, that is to say, the halt in the middle of the day. I looked round, ready to go collecting wood to make a fire, but the kind pilgrims, seeing a lama, invited us to join them. I felt delighted to be free to remain quietly seated, enjoying the scenery, which was grand. In a frame made of several ridges of forest-covered mountains, one above and behind another, a gigantic peak of the Kakapo towered, dazzling white, its summit pointing straight into the dark blue sky. Before it, our group seemed a gathering of tiny animals crawling on the ground. The sight was really crushing, and did indeed remind us of our nothingness. Yet the good pilgrims gave their whole attention to their food and some gossip, and turned their backs on the exalted abode of the gods they had come from afar to worship. As for myself, I was lost in a trance of admiration, forgetting that my attitude might look strange to the Tibetans. As a matter of fact, it did, and they inquired why I did not eat. "Mother is with the gods," answered Yongdan, "who put a warm bowl of tea before me to bring me down to the world of men." A woman, misunderstanding his answer, put a new question about me. "Is the another a Pamo?" she asked. I was afraid that my companion would not be able to suppress his laughter at this funny idea, but he replied, gravely, "My father was an Agspa, as she was initiated his Sangyam. All looked at me with due consideration, and the chief of the party sent me a piece of dried meat. Until then he had offered us only tsampa, but the new personality that we revealed to them inspired respect in these benighted Tibetans. Nagspa are dreaded for the occult powers they are supposed to possess, and to incur their displeasure or that of their kindred, even for involuntary offenses, is a serious matter. So, having suddenly become grave, they made us a little present of butter and tsampa and hastily went their way, desirous to escape our honorable but dangerous company. This was just what we wished. The following day brought us to the limit of the Kakapo forests. From the top of a hill, we saw Aban on the bank of the Larkangra River. This place, where the Chinese used to keep a small garrison, had become, we had been told, a Tibetan frontier post. Our difficulty was now no more action of wandering through solitary forests, but of crossing a populated village which, with its outlying cultivation and isolated farms, stretched for several miles. Our old trick of tramping by night was no longer of any use here. No doubt dogs frequented the road and were likely to be fierce at night, and in any case noisy. One cannot expect a miracle to happen at every turn. Until then we had enjoyed such wonderful luck that prudence naturally prompted us to make allowances for it and not count too much upon its protection. To be caught roving at night would have got us into trouble. Inquiries might follow and we feared nothing more than these. Our best plan, W.C. thought, was to cross Aban before daybreak. By so doing we should get the benefit of darkness, and as Tibetan travelers are in the habit of starting at these early hours on their day's march, anyone who might hear us passing by or see us, would find in it nothing extraordinary. We studied the aspect of the valley from the top of a woody hill in order to be able to proceed quickly in the dark. Fearing to arrive too early in the vicinity of the village, we remained a long time seated there, with the result that, since the road wound, in its descent, more than we had suspected, night fell long before we had reached the bottom of the valley. For the first time since we had left Londera, the weather was really unpleasant. A cold wind pierced our clothes, and low clouds foretold snow. We no longer knew the exact whereabouts of the village. Bushes conspired with the darkness to mislead us. Several times we sat on their ground with our loads on our backs, overpowered by sleepiness. But we could not allow ourselves even the poor comfort of a nap. Before taking whatever rest we might enjoy that night, we needed to ascertain that we had reached the Larkangra Road and that, hurrying through the village a few hours later, we would have only to walk straight before us. Unfortunately, we failed to find the road amongst the intersections of the bypaths. At length we found ourselves near some houses and were compelled to stop. Snow began to fall. To spread our small tent over us like a blanket was out of the question. Once untied, we could not have repacked our loads properly in the dark, and might have left behind us some compromising article. Nothing, therefore, remained for us but to sleep uncovered for a while, with our packs as pillows. Long before daybreak we awoke and started. At a first attempt we luckily reached the center of the village. Hearing voices inside a house and being panic-stricken, we hurriedly turned a corner, ran straight before us, and found ourselves again amongst the fields. In our haste we had mistaken the direction. The early light of dawn revealed the river and we saw that we were going up instead of down the stream as we should. We now had to abandon our carefully considered scheme. We should have to go through Aban in daylight. Country folk were already to be seen going to their work. There was nowhere to hide ourselves, and the longer we waited, the worse our chances would be. People whose hearts are not strong and who cannot sufficiently master their nerves are wiser to avoid journeys of this kind. Such things might easily bring on heart failure or madness. We retraced our steps, passed once more under the windows of the house where we had heard the voices which had frightened us. People were still talking. The blinds were open, and I could see the flame of a fire. These blessed villagers would, 32, drink hot tea, whereas our last meal had been taken early in the morning of the previous day, and we did not feel sure that we should be able to stop to eat during the day which was dawning. All was well. We were on the right road. We went at a good pace and soon passed through the village. But our troubles were not over, for another cluster of houses appeared on a hill overlooking the valley, which narrowed to the size of a gorge, giving passage to the river which entirely filled the bottom of it.